We're holding on to page Nun Dalad in Sanhedrin, about the middle of the page, middle of Oskufchov. We learned yesterday about the whole story with Zimri and Cosby and Pinchas coming in and killing Zimri. So we left off that afterwards he threw down the bodies in front of Hashem and was angrily demanding of Hashem, how could you cause that because of these two people and there are various 24,000 Jews should die? We said the Malachi Ashurus were upset with Pinchas that he talked that way to the Eveshter, and Hashem tells them, leave him alone, he did the right thing. He's a Kanoi ben Kanoi, Meshuv Chema ben Meshuv Chema. He's a zealous person, and he inherited that from his ancestor Levi, and he turned away Hashem's anger just like his grandfather Aaron did. So now the Gemara continues, the page Nundalad in Sanhedrin.
Nundalad in this safer?
Unless you have the wrong volume, then you need volume A.
Okay.
You're in the right room. Okay. So the Gemara says, "Chu shvatim mevazin oisay." So now the other shvatim are all mocking Pinchas. How could he do such a thing? Isen ben Puti there. Have you seen this descendant of Puti? The pasuk tells us in Parshas Va'era that Elazar, his father, married Mibnos Putiel, married one of the daughters of Putiel. And the Gemara, in a couple of places, explains that Putiel has one meaning of Putiel is that she was descended from Yisrael. Whereas they say over here, his grandfather, his mother's father, fattened up calves for Avodah Zarah. And so this guy who came from nowhere, v'horeg nasi shevet Yisrael, and he came and killed a nasi of a shevet, the nasi of shevet Shimon in the Jewish people. Now, why are they mentioning his descent from Yisroi? So for one thing, Yisroi himself worshipped Avodah Zarah. So what makes you yourself come from such a background? They're telling him so where do you come off claiming that you're a Kanoi and killing somebody for consorting with a Goyish woman when you yourself are descended from Kael Mechar as well, like that, like we learned yesterday. Another point that's brought in a number of places that ever brings it in a Sicha is they're saying that's not just that Yisrael worshipped Avodah Zarah, that would be bad enough. It was actually that he fattened up calves for Avodah Zarah, as in like he's pretending to be very kind to them, giving them good fattening food just so he can shech them, and therefore that shows that there's a cruel streak running in the family, and they're claiming that Pinchas is motivated by that. In that sicha that ever points out that they may be doing it also, it's not just to put down Pinchas, they're also doing it in an attempt to defend Moshe and the Jewish people. As we learned yesterday, Pinchas was the only one who stood up to do anything. So they're saying the only guy who bestirred himself to do it is one who's actuated by Achzorius. None of us are like that, and therefore none of us stood up. So instead, the Pasuk now gives his full Yichus, starts off Pinchas ben Elazar ben Aaron HaKoyin. Now, earlier, at the end of Parshas Balak, it also says, Vayar Pinchas ben Elazar ben Aaron HaKoyin. Why does it have to repeat it over here? The reason is because now the Shvatim are making fun of him and claiming that he got this tendency from his grandfather Yisrael. So Hashem needs to inform them, no, just the opposite. He got this tendency from his grandfather Aaron, who was Oyev Shalom, Veroid of Shalom, and he did it completely b'shem Shemayim and completely in order to make Shalom among the Jewish people and between the Jewish people and Hashem. So Amalei HaKadosh Baruch Hu LeMoshe, Hashem tells Moshe, Hakdim Lo Shalom. Go be proactive and give him peace. Tell him that, as the Pasuk says, that Hashem is giving him his covenant of peace, and go give him shalom, in other words, that the Shvatim should stop mocking him and putting him down. This way he'll have shalom from them. Shanema, lochen amur, hinininos, and leis brisi shalom. Therefore, Hashem tells Moshe, say, behold, I'm giving him my kingdom of peace, my covenant of peace. Because now there was a lack of peace, because the other Shvatim didn't accept that Pinchas had done the right thing, so Hashem tells Moshe, tell them that it was. With that said, by the way, an interesting thing is the Gemara tells it now. We have, when did Pinchas become a Kohen? There are different opinions about it. There is an opinion that he had been a Kohen before that as well, but the most well-known opinion is that he became a Kohen only now, because to begin with, the Kohuna had been given only to Aaron and his sons who were anointed with him and any of their future descendants, and Pinchas is not future, because he was already born. So now Hashem gave him the kohuna. There's even an interesting explanation about that. I don't remember the mocker, that uh, Like this, we have a din. A Kohen who kills somebody is not allowed to do the Avodah in the Beis Mikdash. So now, where Pinchas might have been his whole life, he might have been expecting maybe one day the Eibishter will say that I get to join my Zedah and my uncles and my uncle and my father in doing the and cousins and whatever in doing the Avodah. And now comes up this thing with Zimri and Cosby, and there must have at least passed the thought through his mind. You know what? If I kill him, for sure I'm knocking myself out of the corner forever. Nevertheless, he went and did it because he knew that's what the Eibishter wants. And so now Hashem says, fine, you were willing to give up your dream of your lifetime, now I'm giving it to you after all, as a reward for what you did. Anyway, so there's that, but there is also, interestingly, in the Gemara in Zvachim, there's a different opinion that Pinchas didn't actually become a Kohen until many years later. You have a story in Sefer Yoshua, where after they spent 7 years conquering Eretz Yisrael, 7 years dividing it up, and eventually it came time for Bnei Reuven and Gad and Chatzi Shevet Menasheh to head across the Yarden and go home. Go to their houses, reunite with their families and all. And the Pasuk describes how before they crossed over the Yarden, they built a giant Mizbeach. And the other Shevatim got nervous. What does this mean? Are you trying to set up a separate place to bring Korbanos outside the Mishkan? Such a thing is completely usur. And they were about to go to war. So the Pasuk describes, they sent a delegation of the Nesiim headed by Pinchas to ask them, what do you think you're doing? And they explain that, no, fakert, we didn't build this as a place to bring korbanos, just the opposite. It's meant to be a monument that for all time, everybody should realize we're part of the Jewish people, even though we're across the Yarden just as much as you. And if anybody says, hey, you're across the Yarden, you're not one of us, then we say, look, our ancestors built this Mizbeach, and they're dafka not bringing korbanos on it, because they, like everybody else, know the only place to bring korbanos is in the Mishkan and Shiloh. Anyway, the upshot is, the Gemara says that they made peace between them, not averted a civil war. The Gemara says, according to that opinion, that's when Pinchas became a Kohen. So in other words, the idea would be, Mefarshim explained, that here, Hashem had told Pinchas, you did the right thing, hinini noisem lesbisi shalom. Nevertheless, even if people are not making fun of him anymore, I mean, if Hashem's saying that Pinchas did the right thing, they're not going to make fun of him, they still weren't willing to accept necessarily that because of that, he should be able to be a Kohen. So it had to wait until 14 odd years later, when, after this whole thing, where we prevented the civil war. Now everybody saw for sure he's definitely a Mason Shalom and deserves to be a Kohen, and now everybody accepted him as one. Okay. So the Gemara continues, or you want to know how great this kapara was that Pinchas accomplished, or uya kapara zu shetem haperes v'haylechas la'olam. This kapara that he accomplished by what he did is deserving that it should be a kapara for all time for the Jewish people. It should always be a good remembrance for the Jewish people that there was somebody who stood up for Hashem's honor. Marsha points out, the Pasuk doesn't say v'chiper al b'nei Yisrael, which would be a simple past tense. It's v'yechaper, which can also be darshan, b'loshan yochad, as if it said v'chaper, that he will be m'chaper. So we learn from that, it's an ongoing kapara. In fact, there's a medrash, actually, that says that every year on the anniversary of that day when the Jewish people were getting involved with the Bnois Midian and Baal Pa'ur, and every year on the anniversary of that, the klippa of Pa'ur comes and ascends from the ground over there and wants to be mekaterig on the Jewish people, and then he sees Moshe's burial place, which is right near there, that he was also buried at Mul Beis Pa'ur, and then he sinks back down into the ground and gives up. So we see there needs to be an ongoing kapara for it, and so Pinchas' kapara is that.
Date was?
No, we don't know when that date was, at least I don't know. In that story, by the way, in that story with the 2.5 Shevatim and Pinchas, by the way, when the other Nesiim confront the 2.5 Shevatim and they say, what do you think they're doing? And then what do you think you're doing? They actually mention this story as well. They say, what do you think? It wasn't bad enough, the Avera Pa'ur, and we haven't been cleansed from it, Ada Yemazeh, and now you want to make things worse. So we see that they themselves realize that there's a direct connection over here. So that's what Pinchas accomplished. The Gemara says, further on this topic of Pinchas and Zimri and Cosby, Omer of Nachman, Omer Rav, my dichtiv, what does it mean a posik in Mishlei? Zarzir mosnayim oi soyish umelach alkum imoi. Now, what does the simple meaning of the Pasuk mean? Even the simple meaning is kind of hard to understand. Rashi on the Pasuk says he doesn't know what is Zarzir Mosnayim and what is Zarzir Mosnayim Oysoyish and what is Melech Alkum. Rashi says on the Pasuk, I don't know. Different Mephoshim talk about it, about the only word that we can understand in the Pasuk that Rashi says you can understand in the Pasuk is Mosnayim and Imoy. Mosnayim means the hips or the loins, and Imoy means with him. But what does the rest of it mean? So different Mephoshim talk about Zarzir would be some kind of creature. They talk about different possibilities. It can mean And so evidently Zyrosaur must not be some kind of creature that has very swift hips. So a very fast-moving creature. So different Mephoshim talk about it. It can be a swarm of bees. It can be a hunting dog. It can be some kind of bird. The Maharal over here on the Gemara says it may be a chicken, a rooster. Anyway, it says Zyrosaur Mosnai. But in context, the Pasuk is talking about various creatures, Shloshahem, Metive Tsoan, Varbom, Metive Lechas, four creatures that are able to walk very well. So Zyrosaur Mosnai then would be a type of hunting dog or bees or rooster or whatever it is that's able to strut around and run around very fast. Oisoyish, simple meaning Tayish, means a male goat, a billy goat. Umalach Alkumimai, Mephoshim explain that Alkum, on the Pasuk explain that Alkum is a compound of Alkum, not together. So Umalach Alkumimai, and together with him is a king against whom nobody can stand. So that's the simple meaning of the pasuk, more or less. But now, the Gemara takes that pasuk and darshens it about this story with Zimri and Cosby. So, the first word, Zarzir, is Gematria 424. Zion Yud Resh equals 424. Tov Chof Dalad Ve'ilis Bal Rosha. That Rosha Zimri had relations with Cosby 424 times. That's the Zarzir. The Himtin Pinchas loy, and Pinchas was waiting, Mosnayim, Meloshin Himtin, he waited, Adjah Toshash Koichai, until he's weak, Tayish, Meloshin Toshash. So in other words, Zarzim Mosnayim Oisayish. Here, Zimri is busy having his fun over there 424 times, and meanwhile, Pinchas is waiting, and afraid to go and start up with him, until Oisayish, until he figures he's weakened from all the Be'ilus. Meanwhile, v'hu eni yadesh, melech alkumimoy, and Pinchas doesn't realize that the king against whom no one can stand is with him, or not the king that against whom no one can stand. Rashi here has an interesting explanation that the word alkum, Rashi says, is an Arabic word. Al, you have lots of words in Arabic that begin with al, because it's their definite article, it's the equivalent of hey in Hebrew. So the melech alkum would mean the king, that all hakomos, that all the standings are thanks to him. The fact that anybody can stand and anybody can accomplish anything is because Hashem gives them the power. So he didn't realize the melech alkumimai, Hashem who gives him the power to stand, is with him. And why is he waiting that long? Why, meanwhile, Jews are dying in the plague. And why didn't he rush in sooner and kill Zimri rather than waiting for the 424 times? So how are we learning? So what exactly is the connection with this pasuk? Maharsha explains like this. One of the many meanings of Zarzir is a bird that in English is called a starling. Now, the Gemara explains in a couple of places that the starling doesn't in and of itself have simonim of a non-kosher bird. However, it habitually associates with the raven, which does. It hangs around where ravens are, and therefore that's a simon that it's a non-kosher bird. The raven, we're going to learn later in the Masechta, and Perek Chelet was one of the only three creatures that had relations in the Teva when they weren't allowed to. You had Chum, the raven, and the dog. So therefore, the raven is a symbol of being promiscuous, of being very much into Tashmish, even when he's not supposed to. And the Zarzir hangs out with him, and therefore it means it has that nature as well. So therefore, therefore Chazal took this pasuk and mentions this bird Zarzir. According to him, Zarzir would be this kind of bird, and used it to darshan it about Zimri. We're also, and the Tayish, a male goat, is also very much into Tashmish with the female goats. So the pasuk mentions the two of those creatures. They're the ones that very much are into using their hips and having tashmish all the time. And so was Zimri. And meanwhile, Pinchas is waiting, and he didn't realize that Hashem is on his side, and he shouldn't hesitate any longer. The Maharal gives an explanation over here. The Maharal says the Zarzir is actually a rooster, and roosters are also, the Gemara mentions, in a number of places, also very much into their taivas of mating with the females. So the same idea, in other words, that Zimri is being compared to that. And the Maharal says when we say 424 times, we don't necessarily mean literally, that would be impossible. What it means is, in other words, basically, that Zimri would have done that many times if he was capable of. It's like, the Maharal explains Bechlal, it's actually interesting, it was in today's Daf HaYomi as well, the Gemara had an expression that Dibra Torah Loshon Havai and Dibra Chachamim Loshon Havai, that many times the Torah and Chazal talk an exaggerated language. So the Maharal explains it's not really an exaggeration, even though what it means is in our world it's an exaggeration because things in our world don't always managed to live up to, or don't always manage to have the full capabilities that Beruch Nias they would be able to. But so Chazal, when they give us a number, an exaggerated number, means like what's the maximum at a Ruch Nias type level it would be capable of. The Gash Nias doesn't always match it. So here, in other words, the idea would be Zimri, Beruch Nias was capable of and would have, if he had been able to, 424 times, even though in the actual Gash Nias it was a lot less. And therefore, he says the Pasuk is comparing him to the rooster, which is also very much into this kind of thing. So the Gemara continues, Masnisa. The Masnisa Tana, in a Braisa we learn, Shishim, it wasn't 424, it was 60 times. Ad Shanasa ke Beitza HaMuzeres, until Pinchas became like a Beitza HaMuzeres. So a Beitza HaMuzeres is a spoiled egg, or an egg that's been sat on for a little while and is starting to spoil and to decay. So the same way over here, like his own Beitzim are becoming like that. He's producing so much Shishmasera that everything is getting all mixed up and then watered down, kind of.
So Zimri.
No, Zimri. Did I say Pinchas? I meant Zimri. Yeah. So 60 times. Again, 60 is one of those numbers that the Gemara sometimes uses to mean a large number, not necessarily literally 60. So it can be the same kind of thing that it meant that he would have done it 60 times had he been capable of. Many times, in fact, 60 is used, Taka in the Gemara, to represent a certain degree of shleimos, like the ultimate degree of something. So it can mean that. Eitz Yosef and Ben Yehoyada point out, the Gemara is going to say here, we're going to talk about his various names. One of his names is Zimri ben Solu, so we can break down the word Solu into Samach Loi 60 times that he had relations which he wasn't supposed to. And the Braisa continues, Vihi hoisa ka reva hamalei amayin. She in turn, she's so full of Shechva Zera now that she's like a trough full of water. And Rav Kahana says her seat, where the place where she sits, the widest part of her body, would be the size of a beis saw. So again, in the simple sense, these are exaggerations. Beis saw is an area 50 by 50 amas. She wasn't that large. So one possibility is mean that Hashem like made her extra large just for the moment. Another way of looking at it is Yandrama says it means like if you think of the whole area that would have gotten wet with fluids over there, then it would have it soaked up an area of a besa. Tony Rabbi Yosef kever shalama, and Rabbi Yosef says just her kever alone, which is kever is one of the nicknames for the opening of her rechem, was an amma in size. Again, it may have been that Hashem made it an amma on the spot. Yad Rama says it means in the end, as large as we're just saying she was, and as much space as she and everything that comes from her takes up, in the end, she's buried in a grave just an amma in size. So literally, kever shalah, you know, he understands, kever shalah, not her rechem, as Rashi says, but rather the actual cave or the actual grave where they stuck her body. The Gemara continues, Amun of Sheshes, we have an example, the Gemara tells us also, for example, about the Paroi of Moshe Rabbeinu's time, that he was an Amma long, and then in Parmashtakoi, which one of the meanings is his Aver, was an Amma as well. The Maharal gives an explanation of it, and like his whole Metzius is in that area of life. So the same thing over here, when you say Kever Shalama, it can mean the same kind of thing, like her entire Amma, her entire Metzius is all in that. The Gemara says, "Amar of Sheshes, Loi Cosby Shmar. Her real name wasn't Cosby. Ela Shvilnai Bas Tzur Shmar. Her real name was Shvilnai, the daughter of Tzur. Now Tzur was one of the five kings of Midian, as we have them listed in Parshas Matos. So she was his daughter. The Loma Nikashma Cosby. So why is the pasuk calling her Cosby? She Kizva Ba'avia, because she acted disloyally towards her father." Because, as we learned yesterday, here, her father is Rosh Beis of the Minyan Hu. He's the head of a distinguished part of the Minyani nation. And as we learned yesterday, she herself wanted to who's she going to go with? Only with Moshe, the leader of the Jewish people. And instead, Zimri convinced her to go with him instead. So like this, her father would have wanted that Marsha says not so much that. Her father wouldn't have wanted to be masker her for such a thing. She herself wanted it, so therefore you can say Shekizba Vavia, she was disloyal to her father. Her father would have rather she stay in the palace and act like the way a princess should, and she instead decided to do this. Davar Acha, Cosby, another explanation of why she's called Cosby, Sha'omra La'avia, she says to her father, Kois bi amze, through me slaughter this nation. The word kois is an Aramaic word that means to shech. So therefore, Darshan and Cosby, as if it was Cosby, So Kos Bi, Shech, kill through me this nation. In other words, she hated the Jewish people so much she was willing to, like, she'll be the one to offer herself and go commit Znus publicly in order that as many Jews as possible will be killed. So Vahainu Da'amni Inchi. Now, this is what we're saying, her real name is Shvilnai. We see a popular expression that people say, Ben Kani Lo'ubani Shvilnai my boy. What is the Shvilnai doing between? What's Shvilnai doing between the reeds and the urbani, which means Rashi explains thin willow branches. So you have areas of swamps over there where you have willow trees grow over there, and near them there are areas of reeds. This is like a semi secluded area. This is the kind of place where Zonus would go for affairs and things. So what's the Shvilnai doing over there? She must have gone there for Znus. And people continue with the expression. So we see that they use the word Shvilnai to mean a Zoyna, because since the original Shvilnai, this Kosbi Batsur, was like that, so they took her name and used it and started using it as a general name for Zoynas. And the expression that people say is, can they continue? Bahadi Kalfi Dekhani, among the peels of the reeds. People would take the reeds and peel their outer layer and then use them for different purposes. But Shvilnai, my boy, what is Shvilnai doing over there? Again, it's a semi-secluded area. She must have gone there for Znus. Gayafta Le'ima. With that, she's showing her mother to be a Zoyna. People are going to say that if she's a Zoyna, she probably learned that kind of attitude and that kind of behavior from her mother, and her mother is like that as well. So you see that people use the word Shvilnai to mean a Zoyna. Marsha explains that's the vote. In other words, a father is going to look out for the morals of his daughter. He's not going to be so willing to let her go and act like this. But when she does on her own, and she goes into a hefkodika place like that, and she ends up committing znus, then she's motzi shemra on her mother. People think, like mother, like daughter. Rechela bosa, rechela azla, as the Gemara phrases it elsewhere, that the ewe follows the ewe. The female lamb follows her mother. In the same way, if this girl is being mizana, she must have learned that kind of behavior from her mother. That's the gayachalim. She declares, she's showing that her mother is a zoyna as well. But anyway, we see in both parts of this expression, people use the word Shvilnai for a Zoyna. The Gemara continues, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Hamisha Shemus Yeshloi. This Zimri ben Solo actually had five different names. Zimri, or ben Solo. In other words, the Gemara's Darish name, Zimri ben Solo, doesn't just mean that he was named Zimri and his father's name was Solo. The Gemara's understanding that ben Solo tells us something about him himself. Shol or Ben Aknanis, he's also called Shol. He's also called Ben Aknanis. We have in Parshas Vayigash and in Parshas Va'era when it lists the son when it lists the sons of Shimon, then it mentions Shol Ben Aknanis. So the Gemara is understanding that this is the same person.
The same person,
the actual son of Shimon, which in that case, Marsha points out, it would mean he had to be quite old by this time, because he lived through the whole time in Mitzrayim, and this is the end of the 40 years in the desert.
So, the same letters.
What?
Sol and Sol.
Sol and Sol are almost the same letters. True, interesting. Okay. And the fifth one is Ushlumiel ben Surishadai. And the fifth name he has, Shlumiel ben Surishadai, under which name he's listed among the Nasiim in Parshas Bamidbar and Nosei. So, why does he have all these names? And the Maharal makes a point, by the way. He says sometimes you find that five represents, you can talk about a person as five different basic aspects of their personality. On the side of Kedusha, he says, for example, Rabbi Yechon ben Zakkai had five named Talmidim representing like the full spectrum of what different kinds of people are about. So now, in the flip side of it is the Gemara wants to tell us that Zimri was thoroughly evil from core to core, and therefore all five of his names represent something bad. So with Zimri, Al Shanasika Beitza Muzeres. So Zimri goes, like we said before, that it became like Beitza Muzeres. Zimri is, you rearrange the letters, you get Muzer. Ben Solu, why is he called Ben Solu? Al Shehisli Avonis from Shvachte. Because Hisli, the Averis of his family. Rashi says two explanations of Hisli. One is he caused them to be remembered and told about. We find Psukim that use that shodesh, samach lamed hey or samach lamed aleph, to refer to comparing, to mentioning or comparing. So therefore, like, people would compare and mention, look at this, he and his whole family are Menachem and Zonim. So he causes that kind of, causes people to look down on his whole family because of that. The other explanation Rashi says is that the word solu shehisli can mean meloshin the south of the side, like a person plays around with and curls and his hair. So it means, in other words, that he caused that their avedas are going to be carefully searched out and looked after and commented on. So he did that by doing that. And we see, for example, that when it came to the brachas in Parshas Vezoz HaBracha, Moshe didn't even give a separate bracha to Shevet Shimon because of this whole story. He just included the bracha for Shimon in the bracha for Shevet Yehuda. When he says, Shema Hashem Kir Yehuda is a remez to Shimon. So that's that. Shol, why is he called Shol? Al Shehisho Atzmi L'Dvar Aveira. Because he allowed himself to be borrowed to do an Aveira. What is he doing? What is he doing such a thing? So it's almost like he allowed himself to be hired or borrowed into doing this kind of thing. Ben Aknanis is called Al Shalsa, Maisa Knan, because he acted like the Knanim who are famous for their znus, or infamous for their znus. And Umashmoy, and what's his real name? Shlomiel ben Tzvi Shadei Shmoy. His real name is Shlomiel ben Tzvi Shadei. Which, according to that, Marashah says that if you're going to say that he's the same as Shol ben Achnanis, then why? Where does the Tzvi Shadei come from? He should be called Shol ben Shimon, would be the fifth name, but or Shlomiel ben Shimon. But okay. The Medrash actually says it somewhat differently. The Medrash says that he's called Shlomiel because when he was among the Nasiim originally in Parshas Bamidbar and Nosa, he was a tzaddik. He had shalom with Kael. He was at peace with Hashem. Nothing wrong with him. Only now, later on, at the end of the 40 years, is when he went bad. Marsha points out, now you can't say, for example, that the original Nasi of Shevet Shimon had passed away, and now they appointed this Zimri ben Solo instead, because we don't find such a thing. We find the Nasiim being appointed in Parshas Bamidbar. We find afterwards when the next generation, the previous Nasiim, had passed away, so you have new ones appointed in Parshas Maaseh. There's no time in between when it says anything about new Nasiim being appointed, so we have to understand, therefore, that it was the same one as before. So that's that. So that's the end of that. That's the end of that story with Zimri and Cosby. In the middle of this piece about Tanoim Koygimboy, the Gemara had mentioned something that Abchir Bar Avuya had said in this connection. So now the Gemara interjects with something else that Abchir Bar Avuya says. This story is in Yaakov. You put it over here, I guess, in order not to break up the whole thing with Haboril Aramis. It's also, by the way, this story is also repeated later on in the Gemara in Perek Chelek as well. Although it's not repeated in Yaakov there again. But anyway. One of the last kings of Yehuda, the third to last king, was named Yehoyakim. And we'll learn about in Perek Chelek, he was a tremendous Rasha. Among all the kings of Yehuda, there were various kings of Yehuda that were Rishoyim, he was one of the worst of all of them. The Gemara even discusses over there, why is he not on the list of the Melochim that lost their Chelek on Abba? And the Gemara gives reasons, one of them having to do with the story over here. Anyway, the Gemara mentions over there various terrible things that he did. So now the Gemara says, Omer Abchir Bar Avuya, Kosev al Gugolte Shal Yehoyakim, it's written on the skull of Yehoyakim, the words Zois V'Oid Acheres, this and also another one. In other words, he's already been punished once, and he's yet to suffer another punishment. Now, what happened with Yehoyakim in his lifetime was he was king of Yehuda for 11 years. As I said, he was a notorious, terrible Rasha. Among others, for example, a few days ago was Tisha B'Av. He's the one who, when they brought him Yumi's scroll, Megillah Secha, instead of paying attention to it, he's saying, we got to do tshuva to prevent all this from happening. He took the whole thing and then cut it up and ripped it up and threw it in the fire. Then he wanted to arrest Yumi and Baruch, and Hashem saved them. And there's various other things that we find that he did wrong. There's a number of things that the Navi criticizes him for. Anyway, in the end, so now what happened was when he first became king, Mitzrayim was the local superpower. They had actually his younger brother Yehoyachaz had been king first. Pari Nechoy had taken Yehoyachaz prisoner and brought him to Mitzrayim, and he appointed this Yehoyakim as the new king. A few years after that, Nebuchadnezzar comes to power in Babel, and he goes and conquers Eretz Yisrael, and he becomes the new ruling, the new superpower in that part of the world. And Yehoyakim becomes his vassal. This is in Yehoyakim's fourth year. Yehoyakim is loyal to Nebuchadnezzar as a vassal for 3 years. Then he decides, I've had enough of that. He rebels against Nebuchadnezzar. Takes 3 years until Nebuchadnezzar gets around to dealing with it. He brings his army, besieges Yerushalayim. And the upshot is that Yochum was killed. The Medrash goes into detail about it. The Chachamim, the Sanhedrin, went to talk to Nebuchadnezzar. Where are you coming to Bechlal to destroy the Beis Hamikdash? What exactly is your agenda? He says, no, I have nothing against you, but your king Yochum is a rebel, and I want him handed over. And they go to Yehoyakim and try to convince him to surrender, and he refuses to. And the Medrash says they ended up forcibly lowering him from the wall of Yerushalayim. And then the Gemara brings different opinions over there. Is it that they killed him? Is it Nebuchadnezzar's army killed him? Is it that maybe he was a delicate, pampered kind of person, and he couldn't take that kind of treatment, and he died on the way? Whatever that is, he's dead. One of Yumio's nevuahs had been about him, as the Gemara is going to quote, that a Yumio said he's not even going to get a proper burial. So Rav Chiya Bar Avuya says, now on his skull, there's written the words, Min HaShemayim, Zois V'Oid Acheres. So what happens? V'Kone de Rav Preda, the grandfather of Rav Preda, which is actually this very same Rav Chiya Bar Avuya, Rashi says, Ashkacha hu gogalta to have a shadi of a shadi of Yerushalayim. One time he saw a skull lying around in the gates of Yerushalayim, and this is in the times of the second Mishnah, so you're talking hundreds of years after Yochum's times, and it's set out of these words, Zois v'oid acheres. So, it's a skull. It's a skull of a person. You can't leave it lying around in Yerushalayim. It'll be metame and covered on this. Kavra, so he buried it in the ground. But then it popped out of the ground. Kavra, he tried to bury it again. And again, it popped out of the ground. It wouldn't stay buried. Omar, so he said...
Scary movie.
Maybe to digress a moment, actually, I'll tell another story in this connection. Also, a bone that pops out unexpectedly. The Medrash tells of one of the Chachamim who one time was walking along the cliffs along the coast of Eretz Yisrael, and he sees a bone rolling around over there. And again, and not only covered on mess and all, but it's very dangerous. If somebody trips over this thing, he's going to fall off the cliffs into the ocean. So he tries to bury it, and again, it keeps on popping out of the ground. And finally, he realizes, you know what, this is obviously Min HaShemayim. Let me leave it alone. A few days later, comes a Roman messenger carrying some letters with new Xeris from the government against the Jewish people, and he's walking along that cliff road, and he trips over the bone and falls into the sea, and that's the end of him, and that's the end of his letters. Anyway, getting back to the story over here. So now Rav Chiya Bar Avuya thinks to himself, Dilma hai gugalto shel Yehoyakim. Maybe this is the skull of Yehoyakim. Dichtiv dei, where the Pasuk says about him, Kvoras chamor yikover, he will be buried like a donkey. Nobody makes a leviah for a donkey. Now one way you could look at it is Rashi explains, you just leave it lying around on the ground. Marsha points out you wouldn't necessarily do that because, after all, you don't want it to spread disease or Tumas Nevela or whatever. So you would bury it, but you'd bury it in a shallow grave. You'd dig the minimum amount just to cover it with some dirt. So the Novi is saying that this is what's going to happen to your Yochim. Anyway, the Pasuk says, Kvoras Hamur Yikavu, he's going to be buried like a donkey. Sochet Vahashlech Meholo L'Shar Yishlayim, dragged out and thrown out outside the gates of your Yerushalayim. So he's not going to get properly buried, so this skull must be from him. Omar, but Rav Chiya Bar Avuya thinks to himself, look, after all, Malkahu, he's first a king, v'lav urach arel v'zuyeh, it's not derech eretzik that he should be treated so disrespectfully like that. So fine, if I can't bury him, if it won't stay in the ground, then we got to do something else with him. Shakla, so he took the skull, karcha b'shiroi, he wrapped it up in silk, as befits the head of a king, but Osve the sifter, and he put it in a chest. Basically, he'll leave it over there until he can figure out what to do with it. Meanwhile, I think Ben Yehoyada points out the silk will be almost like tachrichim, and the box will be like an orange, so it'll be like a mini kvura until he can figure out what to do. Well, also Devesu Chazisa. So his wife came home and sees this box over there with a wrapped up skull in it. Nachas Omrelo Lahulashiva Basah. She goes and tells her neighbors, whether I have this strange thing in my house, what do you think it is? Omrelo, so one of her neighbors tells her, I de itza kamaisi, this must be the skull of your husband's first wife. Delay Kaminshilo, he can't forget her, so he's keeping her skull as a souvenir. Well, she didn't like that idea at all. Shagauta la Tanura, so his wife just fired up the oven, and she put the skull in there, and she burnt it. He also, when Rav Chiya Bar Avuya came home and found out what happened, Omar, he says, Heinu Dichtiv, so now I understand what it means. Zois v'oid acheres, this and also something else. So in other words, he was punished one time in his lifetime that he was killed in whatever way it was, and he didn't get buried. And now, hundreds of years later, he gets the other punishment that he b'chlal gets buried, that what's left of him, the last piece of him that was left, his skull got burnt. So Maharal Shor explains, you know, at this point you can say he was already, the pasuk Kvoras Chamor Yikover has already been fulfilled. The fact that it kept on popping out of the ground, so it didn't stay buried, so that with that he was yoitza that kind of. But now you had another thing. Later on, the Gemara points out, we're not done yet, we still have 11 minutes. Yeah. Later on, in Perek Chelek, when we learn about Yehoyakim, we're going to learn about various things that he did, that he did, various evil things that he did. So among them is the Gemara mentions over there he had a name tattooed on his aver. The Gemara has two different opinions. Either he has a name of Hashem tattooed over there, which b'chlal, aside from the issue of tattooing, it's like to show bizoyan for Hashem. Or the other opinion is he had a tattoo of a name of Avodah Zarah there, as if like to say like his whole metzius is dedicated to Avodah Zarah. And as you have that, and you have different other averus that it says over there that he did, so therefore the double punishment that he received over here is mida k'negan mida of those things that he did. He put up a disorder in the Bis Mikdash and he whatever, so therefore we are going to have the story repeated over there later. But the Gemara mentions a number of things that he did wrong over there. So now, because of that, is why he deserves this extra punishment. Next, Elohim Anachnok in Perek Asiri. So the 10th Perek of the Masechta finishes off, continues with the topic of people who are chayav the Dalad Mrs. Gastin, the people who are chayav Chenek. In the Mishnayos, by the way, it's the other way around. In Mishnayos, and I think in the Yerushalmi as well, you have Perek Chelek, and then you have this Perek. And in the Gemara, it's first this Perek, Elohim Anachnok, and then Perek Chelek is the last one. Anyway, one of the people who gets one of the cases the mission describes of somebody who gets chenek is a child who, a person who injures his father or his mother. Maki over v'imen most yumos, and when it says most yumos without specifying, then it means chenek. So the Gemara deals with the various dinim of it, and one of the questions is boil lahu. So they had a question: Ben Maush Yakis Dam La'aviv. Can a son do bloodletting for his father? Now, the Gemara establishes for him to be chayav misa, it has to be not just, for example, let's say that he hits or punches his father, he has to actually either draw blood or at least cause a bruise, which also is drawing blood just under the skin. So now, is he allowed to draw blood and do bloodletting for his father? Ramasna says, yes, after all, says, v'haftalorecha kamarcha, and he's doing it for his father's benefit, so therefore he should be doing it. Reb Dimi bar Chanina Omar, and similarly, Reb Dimi bar Chanina says, you have a pasuk that then, where do we know? Now the Gemara explains, the fact that a person is chayav misa for hitting his father or mother, that we have a pasuk in Parshas Mishpatu, Maka Ovdim and Mois Yomas. But we have a general rule that you can't oinshin elam kin mazhirin. For there to be a punishment in the Torah, there has to be some place in the Torah where it warns, don't do this. So where is there an explicit thing in the Torah that says, don't hit your father or don't hit your mother? So the Gemara explains that's not really the thing. The Gemara explains that we learn from the fact you're not allowed to hit any yid, and your father is a yid after all. But what it is is rather. The Gemara discusses how we know that the hitting has to involve wounding in order for him to be chayim. So the Gemara explains because you have a pasuk at the end of Parshas Emor where it describes Makeh Behemi Yishamena. The pasuk says a person who strikes an animal has to pay for it, or Makeh Adam Yumos, and one who strikes a person is put to death. So we learn from that one meaning of it is a Makeh Adam means a person who hits his father or his mother, and the comparison to Behema is a person is not going to be chayev for injuring somebody else's, for hitting somebody else's animal just if he doesn't actually cause an injury. A person goes over and gives a slap to somebody else's cow, he's not going to be chayev for anything, only if he draws blood. Therefore, we can learn from that the same way, to be chayev nisa, for hitting a parent, there has to have to draw blood. Well, therefore, so Dimi Bachanin Amma, Maka Odom and Maka Behena. So then you have this comparison between hitting a person, such as a parent, and hitting an animal. So from that we learn, Ma Maka Behena Lurifua Potter. Now, if you go and injure somebody else's, if you go and draw blood from somebody else's animal because you're trying to heal it because you're a veterinarian, Potter, you're Potter for the Hezek. Af Maka Odom Lurifua Potter, the same way if you're doing it for your father and you're doing it for the Fua. then it would also be potter. So now, when he says potter, does he mean that he actually could? Does he mean maybe it's better not to, but at least the person is not high mesa for it? Well, the Gemara says, Rav le shavat le brei le mishkal le silva. Now, Rav would not allow his son to even take out a splinter for him, because in the course of taking it out, he might accidentally cause him to bleed. So even though, as we're saying, maybe he'd be potter, but Rav didn't want to take the chance that his son is going to be over on any trace of the Avera. Similarly, Ma Brei de Rabina, the Shavat Le Brei, the Miftach Le Kavza. And by the same token, Ma Brei de Rabina would not allow his son to open up a burn. So if he had gotten burnt on some part of his skin and he needs to open it up to get out the pus, then again, he wouldn't allow his son to do that. Dilma Chovil, because he might accidentally cause him bleeding, Bahavale Shigas Isser, and it comes out that it's a shogig of an Isser, which is Misa. Now, there obviously don't mean to be no Misa in that case, but you still don't want to be doing something b'shogig that kind of action would be Chayiv Misa. So the Gemara says, Yehochi Achonami, well, then nobody should be allowed to do it. You're not allowed to injure any yid. And the answer is Acha Shigas Lab. If another person accidentally causes him to bleed, well, he shouldn't. Worst comes to worst. He was doing a shogig of something where maximum the penalty would be allowed for hitting another yid and injuring him. But if with his son, shogigas chenek, you're talking about a shogah of something which could be potentially chayiv chenek, and therefore these Amoroim didn't want to take the chance and allow their son to do it. So the halacha is actually basically that if there's somebody else available, and not just as far as splinters and burns and things like that. Let's say, for example, imagine, for example, a son is a surgeon and his father comes in for surgery. If there's somebody else available, then better let somebody else do it. If not, then he's allowed to.
If he's the mumcha,
then yeah. If he's like the local mumcha and there's nobody better, then he's allowed to. But otherwise, you should have, if at all possible, you should have somebody else do it.
Kipper, you could do mafus on your...
On your father? That's a good question. I mean, lechora there's no chance of causing bleeding. At least I hope not. So lechora, it's still not derech eretz did. The Gemara does actually mention in Makkos that if a father is chayiv malchus, the son, even though the son is the chazan based him, the one who usually gives the malchus, he shouldn't be the one to give it to his father. So yeah, maybe this would be the same kind of thing. Yeah. The father can give the son malchus, right?
Okay. During the rest of the year.
Also during the rest of the year, this is true. Yeah. Okay. Yom Yom Mashiach Ha'Geula for Chamisha Asabav. Tuba Av, Chazal tell about it, that the Loiho Yom Tovim in Israel, there were no greater Yom Tovim for the Jewish people than Tuba Av and Yom Kippur. And you have the various things that the Gemara lists that happened on that day. One of them is, so now you have there's the day when the people stop dying in the Midbar, there's the day when it's the day when the power of the sun weakens, and therefore they stop cutting wood for the Mizbeach, because they're going to start getting wormy, the day when the people who were killed in Beitar will finally be able to be buried. So these are all things that have to do with the Churban. Then you have Tuva Av is also the day when the Shvatim are allowed to intermarry, and when everybody is able to be Olal Regel, when they took away the guards that Yeravim had put up. So these are things having to do with the building of this Mikdash. And the Gemara tells us, Mikan Ve'elach, from Tuba Avanan, Demosif Yosef, anybody who increases his time of learning Torah, his life will be increased. This was in the Living Torah video, this past Matzah Shabbos as well. So now, also, from the 15th is the day of the, when the moon is full, Kaim Asir Bashlamosa. So from that, we'll come to the, very soon, Ba'agolad Idan, to the filling in of all the things of Bnei Yisrael that are all Shem Asirim Les Kadosh Mosa, and have a complete Mili B'gula Amidus Bashlam. Continuing on halachas of tefillin, we're talking about what you do so we're talking about the brachas on the tefillin. So we talked about the bracha l'haniach tefillin yesterday. So now, when it comes to the bracha al mitzvah tefillin, the proper nusach is al mitzvah tefillin with a patach and not mitzvos. Because it's not two mitzvahs, it's only for one. It's only for the tefillin shalosh, which is one mitzvah by itself. Now, brachas on mitzvahs, the general rule is you say them before you do the mitzvah. So the tefillin shayad, make the bracha after you put it on your biceps, but before you tie it, because the tying is considered the beginning of doing it. It's considered the beginning of the fulfillment of the mitzvah. So especially for us that we have the loop that you open and close, and then before you close that loop is when you make the bracha. I know there are some Lubavitcher chassidim that hold that you don't, and then some rabbanim that hold you don't have to open and close the loop every day. So for them it would just be when you're going to tighten the strap to get the tefillin in place. So you make the bracha before that. for the tefillin shorosh. If you're going to make a bracha on them, you're going to put it after you put it on your head, but before you put it tightly in place, because that putting it in its correct place, that would be the beginning of the asiyah. Don't make the bracha before you put it on the biceps or before you put it on the head, because the bracha is supposed to be as close as possible to fulfillment of the mitzvah.
Sure, okay. Sure, yeah.